This is with Donna Marie Doherty on Highland Radio. The kids are in charge to explore all things sustainable. Ours to Protect is funded by Commission Amman with a television licence fee and is a partnership between Highland Radio and the Independent Broadcasters of Ireland.
Good evening and welcome to the final episode of Ours to Protect of the series. It's been a fabulous 6 months. And we've covered so much. This evening, there's two things I want to talk to you about, but the first of it is going to be all things farming.
Ireland has always had a close relationship with the land, and to this day, agricultural products make up a significant fraction of Irish output.
So I spoke to Martin Mortimer first, and he's an assistant agricultural advisor with GreenTrack. So that means that he goes out and visits farms every day to tell them how they can improve their sustainability and get a money reward for it through grants.
The current scheme focused on the environment is the ACRES scheme. That's very much focused on water quality. So you select actions that suited each farm. Not all farms would be suitable for the scheme, but the vast majority there would be something there for them. For taking out different actions, the department will pay a set figure per action or per hectare of land and so on. So it might be riparian buffer zones to prevent runoff into the water courses. So a farmer is giving up some of his land that in the past he may have used for crops or he may have used for grazing. It's fenced off to give a buffer between the field and to the water course that it goes into, and advising of the use of low emission slurry spreading equipment for the spreading of slurry that is going directly into the soil and reduces emissions into the environment. And so certain farms can get payment for using this process, which is being brought in more widely across the farming sector anyway now. Then there's other things that would benefit the environment, such as winter bird food plots. So setting out, so you'd have a field which traditionally you may have grazed, might not have been your best grazing land. But if you close that off for the winter for the whole duration of the scheme, and set out a winter bird food crop that supports the birds through the winter. So the farmer is losing that. He's not able to graze it anymore, but he is getting reimbursed for doing that kind of action, you know.
I suppose I just want to take a little step back for a moment. Now, you go out along with your colleague Dennis and you visit multiple farms. Sometimes whenever we think about farms, we can think nearly like, oh, McDonald's, there's like a farmer and a wife, they have a few kids and they have a few chickens and a few cows running around the place. You know, what's the scale and the size of the farms that you're visiting?
Yeah, it's very varied, although many of the farms in Donegal are extensively grazed, which means there's very few head of sheep or cattle on the area of land that they've got. We look at hill ground, which is, you know, commonage ground, all over Donegal, and it's very lightly grazed, really, considering for the amount of land that is there. So there'd be a lot of traditional old hill farms in Donegal, and they'd be clients as well, but they still have responsibilities to keep that ground in good agricultural and environmental condition. So they'd be lowly stocked, maybe have a significant area of hill ground, then only a small amount of green grassland. So they need to be careful that they remain extensive and don't overuse the small amount of green land that they have, because the nutrients that are there would then build up the limits within the soil, you know. But then we would have a number of dairy farmers, which are the other end of the scale, which is much more intensive. They need every bit of land they have for grazing the cattle and also to distribute nutrients that are created. And then we've got mixed farmers, which are sort of beef fattening farmers, which will have cattle housed throughout the winter, but then be grazed through the summer period. And it's a real mix, mainly livestock farmers, But then there was some where there's a mix with arable land and some that are purely arable as well. You know, there's a real mix across Donegal.
I want to jump next to this question that I got from a young person that I did then put to Martin.
It's a known fact that methane gas, which is emitted from cows, has a detrimental effect on our environment. Methane emissions contribute to climate change at a much faster rate than carbon dioxide. However, it's not like we can just stop cows from burping. So is there anything that we can do to stop it?
There are breeding processes that where livestock are being bred that have a reduced level of emissions that they give out in methane. But also by selling off livestock at a younger age reduces the amount of emissions that they would produce. But it's not something that's going to go away. As long as we want to continue drinking milk and produce meat, it's just something that we have to try and deal with. The use of anaerobic digesters, which are turning grass, slurry, etc., into a usable fertilizer without the use of oxygen, that then will reduce the amount of methane emissions. Mm-hmm. Currently, we only have around 15 or 20 on the island, but we need something like 150, 200 of these anaerobic digester units, but they are incredibly expensive and not always the most practical because they could be a long distance away from the farm for them to be getting any benefit out of it. But by producing gases from this, it reduces our greenhouse gases, you know.
And I'm just going to interject here again with this suggestion that I got to try and nip it in the bud.
Stop cows from farting and burping. Put them on a dad's paddy. Dun, 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 dun.
You could introduce it to a unicorn and set out some jokes and play a tea party with it and play with it and play hide and seek with it.
An absolutely fabulous suggestion that we got in on that one. Now, I did ask Martin about some of the success stories that he's come across from his work with GreenTrack.
Certainly in the last 2 or 3 years, the number of farms, mainly dairy, but it could be also potato growers, the purchase of solar panelling on the roofs of the farms, reducing their energy consumption, which they're able then to solar power the farm, but also the domestic dwelling that's close to the farm as well. And that's one. Also, low emission slurry spreading equipment. There's been a 60% funding for anybody wanting to purchase low emission slurry spreading equipment. But it does show the commitment that that the farmer's prepared to put into this. You know, they really are working very well with both the Department of Agriculture, the EPA and the local councils to do, you know, as much as they can.
Now, you also heard Martin talk about water quality and buffer zones, and I got talking to Trish Murphy, who's a project officer with the Inishowen's River Trust, and they've done extensive work with farms, including some buffer zone work.
The different types of pollution that you'll get revolve mostly around nitrates and phosphates, but also things like sediment and then pesticides. So they'd be the main groups of pollutants that you would get into the rivers. There's a few different ways that they can, specifically from a farm. There's a thing called runoff. I'm sure you've heard of that. So runoff can come from your fields. So fields can be compacted, and if you spread a fertilizer or maybe slurry and it rains, then that can get just washed down into the river. So that's one way that it can get in. Another way is runoff coming from a hard surface like a farmyard. So you might have, you know, a bit of silage leakage or slurry pit leakage in a farmyard that actually gets washed off down into the river as well. But also things like soil erosion is an issue too. So if you have a bit of ground that's poached, maybe around a trough, or maybe at the banks of a river, then that causes the soil to erode into the river, and that carries pollutants with it. And sediment itself is a big problem in rivers too.
And what would be, you know, like the short-term and long-term effects on the ecosystems in the rivers from all the runoff?
So, I mean, it depends on the type of pollutant that goes into the rivers. But say, for instance, the nitrates and the phosphates can cause what they call algal blooms. So algal blooms is when you get these high level of nutrients that go into the river, and it causes all these kind of algae to grow, and they choke up the river. And they can, like, that can happen in the short term if you have a pulse of pollutants going in, but longer term that can result in these the river becoming totally choked up. And it can also lead to things like these blue green algae blooms that we're getting in Loch Ness and some of the other lakes around Ireland now. So that's a very, very serious issue. But we also they also cause things like a lack of oxygen, or maybe increase the temperature in the water short term. And that might reduce the amount of oxygen that's available for the fish and the insects that live in the river. And also, I suppose, pesticides is a big thing. So from a short term impact, if you have pesticides going in, that can kill insects and fish, everything for miles and miles. River. So the pesticides issue is very acute and very impactful. But longer term, things like a lot of sediment going into the river. So say you have erosion on the bank and that sediment is just leaking out into the river all the time, then that blocks up all the gravels in the river. So you have to kind of think about it from the perspective of the animals that live there. So the fish need gravels to spawn in. So they will lay their eggs in between the little spaces in the gravel. But if the gravel is clogged up with sediment, then they can't lay their eggs there. And also, if you have a lot of sediment or algae that's around the larger cobbles and the boulders in there, then the insects that live in there too have less space in which to live. So it affects them as well. So it's the insects need spaces to live. If you don't have the insects, then the fish have no insects to eat and the fish can't lay their eggs. And so it's a whole cycle of, you know, the biodiversity declining in the river.
Now, it's not all doom and gloom, because there are ways now that we're working around this, and that's where you guys come in. So you just work with the farmers. I suppose, what would be the recommendations that are being made?
Right. So for the farmers, there's a big emphasis now on, you know, being very mindful around water. So creating buffers is a really big thing now. So, and the Inishowen Rivers Trust worked on a project with some farmers creating buffer zones on the Culdaff River there a few years ago. But it's always something that we do. And when I talk about tree planting, quite often our tree planting is along near the river. So what happens when you have a buffer zone is that any runoff that's coming off from a field will run down into the trees or into the hedges, and it will be absorbed by them. So the pollutant actually doesn't get into the river then. So it's a really good way to protect the rivers. So a lot of the schemes that are around now are about planting hedgerows, planting trees along the river banks, but also even just leaving a space. You know, like sometimes somebody might plough the field right up to the edge, particularly if you're, you know, planting a crop, they might plough it right down to the edge, and that's very bad for the river. So you need to keep back. And so there's lots of rules now about trying to keep back a bit further, keeping your livestock out of the river as well. So they're all really positive measures as well, because if the river's healthy, then it benefits your farm as well. And it's very, very good for your farm to have good, healthy water. For your stock, but also to encourage that wildlife in, because it helps with pest management. You know, you can get a lot of pests, particularly around your crops. But if you've got a very healthy, thriving food web going on your farm, then you'll have less of an issue with pests like that.
Is there any other success stories from yourselves that you want to share now?
Right. Well, I mentioned earlier that we are involved in the Farming for Water. EIP. This is a very, very large project that's been run by LawPro and Chagas, and also the Dairy Initiative of Ireland. So they've come together to offer farmers money to improve their activities around waters and how they can manage that better. So there's a whole range of actions there as well. And one of the things that they have done is they've given out posts to to community groups around Ireland. Now, there's just five of them, but they've actually, the Inishowen Rivers Trust was successful in getting one of those posts. So we have a staff member who actually works directly with farmers, talking specifically just about how they're managing water on their farms. So they sit down with the farmer and do what they call a rainwater management plan. So it's all the water that's coming onto their farm or running through their farm. How is it being managed? What does it, what's the condition of it? What's the quality of the water like? And how can they improve it? Because farmers are the most important people when we're talking about water quality. And I know that they sometimes, that, you know, there's a lot of talk about agriculture being the biggest problem that we have in terms of water quality. But the farmers are also the ones who can solve the problem the most. So they've got this opportunity to do take on some really good actions to improve water quality across Ireland. From the Rivers Inishowen Rivers Trust perspective, we love to chat to people and get ideas from them. And then those ideas can lead into bigger projects. So we've had people coming to us about, you know, doing things organically and how can we solve this problem. So we've actually worked with different groups to create projects that have been really, really successful and really useful in the community. And we would encourage people to volunteer as well, because it's really good. And we take all ages and we go into schools as well. So we're just starting a schools, a run of school workshops now this month. So we just go in and talk to people, just learning more about what's in your rivers, because it's one of the things that I always find that farmers are very interested in when you go to the river with them and you show them the life that's in the river and you talk to them a little bit about how they can assess what condition that their river is in. You know, if they give it a bit of a kick and if loads of you know, cloudy, murky water kicks up, that's not a particularly good sign. And also if they pick up stones, they should be able to see little animals crawling around on the stones. And that's a very good sign. Okay, so you can teach people little things about this, about keeping an eye on things themselves. They don't have to have, you know, special equipment to test this kind of thing. There's little jobs that you can do just to make sure that the water running through your farm is a good quality.
Here is another interesting point raised by one of our young people who was talking to me about farming.
Fertilizers and pesticides, overgrazing, monoculture, and overall intensive farming has the power to disrupt ecosystems. But modern farming methods are still used nationwide, despite the adverse effect it poses on biodiversity. Is the government planning to change this?
I spoke with Michelle and Cahill Donnelly, who run Mulroy Meadow Farmyard, and they have a really interesting approach.
Myself and Cahill, we actually bought the farm 5 years ago. Neither of us are from Fannet, where the farm is. It's a small 14-acre mixed regenerative farm. So we have pasture-raised hens, so we sell pasture-raised eggs. We have forest-raised traditional breed pork, grass-fed Dexter beef, and this year we also started a market garden and a polytunnel where we have been selling mainly tomatoes and salad crops.
What does regenerative farming mean?
Regenerative farming is concentrating on the soil, so everything comes from the soil, so we are trying to regenerate, bring life to the soil, which brings life and hope and everything to our lives and the lives of our community and rural life in general. So we're trying to regenerate our entire ecosystem and our entire community with this farming technique, which is concentrating on soil to grow everything from the soil.
Yeah, we believe healthy soil will create healthy grass and healthy forage for our animals, which in turn will have healthy animals providing healthy food and hopefully healthy people in our community as well.
So would that be kind of naturally native to there is what you'll grow there, rather than trying to pump things into the soil to try and suit something that mightn't usually grow there? Is that a right enough way to look at it?
Yeah, that would be correct. The easiest way, I suppose, to think about it is a blend of traditional methods mixed with the new technology and science of today to back it up. We're trying to mimic nature with the animals and what they do. And like, I'll give you an example. We have our cattle going first and they eat the grass. So we only allow them to eat about 50% of the grass. And then we move them on the hens come in after, they trample the grass down more, they spread the cattle's manure around, so they're fertilising the ground, they're trampling down the grass, they're building organic matter, they're storing nutrients, and then that patch of grass will be rested for about 30 to 35 days until we circulate right round again. So everything keeps moving all the time.
It's definitely more labour intensive.
Absolutely.
But for the farmer, there is, cost wise, it is more beneficial to the farmer because you're not paying for chemical inputs.
Hmm.
Now, what you do pay in your time and in your, as I say, in your labour, but we do believe it's a more sustainable way for a farmer to make a living.
It also reconnects the farmer with the land and the communities with the land and the land with the food with the people. So it's a whole big circular motion to reconnect people with their farmers and their farms and their rural communities.
And you have been very open with your farm. You have tours during the summer, and then you are open as well to like school students coming in, and there's like sort of an educational element in it.
Yeah, so Cahill's background, he has a Bachelor's of Science in Environmental and Marine Science.
Yeah, and I grew up on my grandma's farm. I've done the Level 6 in Agriculture. And Michelle, then you can...
Yeah, I have a Master's in Pharmacy, so I practice. I'm still practicing as a pharmacist, and I'm currently studying a Master's in Organic and Biological Agriculture. So we both have the scientific knowledge and backing to support what we're doing at the minute, and we just want to share this with, well, as many people as we can, but especially the younger generations coming behind us. We want to kind of encourage and inspire them to see that farming this way, it is the future, and it's a viably financial career and an incredibly rewarding way to farm as well. So we just want to share that as much as we can. We've had all ages out to the farm, so we've had preschool groups, we've had national school, the whole way through secondary, we've had TY students, leaving cert.
We had a big farmer training event 3 weeks ago, and we're actually in talks to do another two-day farmer training event on the 8th and 9th of November. We're going to be incorporating another thing called Korean Natural Farming into that, which everybody's very excited about within the farming community. It's a way of speeding up your soil regeneration, I suppose, would be the easiest way to put it. You're trying to bring the knowledge of like an ancient Irish woodland onto your grassland so the whole ecosystem can communicate like a forest floor.
Yeah. And again, it just negates the need for all these chemical inputs such as your fertilisers, your pesticides. You're going to increase your land's pest resistance and its productivity through these Korean natural farming inputs, which are, well, they're very, very interesting, but they're also much, much less expensive to make. You know, you're talking peanuts in comparison to your fertilizer costs, so yeah.
And by going down this route then, do you eliminate a lot of waste as well?
We have very little waste on the farm. We try to close as many waste loops as we can. Like, we have the pigs who get our own food scraps, but they also get eggs that aren't fit for selling, I suppose.
Yeah,
if they're cracked or dirty or that kind of thing. So the pigs get our eggs, and
we were working with a distillery up the road. We were getting his spent grain whenever he would be making whiskey, so we were feeding him that mixed in with the eggs. But we give all our animals get organic feed, so it'd be nicer to be more sustainable with the food. But in regards to waste, we pretty much close all our loops. Our hens in the winter would get wood shavings. So the wood shavings is their bedding, and once that's finished, then we can compost that down and use that in the market garden.
That's brilliant. So it is. And then I suppose just in terms of water, how would your water usage compare to maybe a traditional farm?
Yeah, like, water isn't, it's never really something we talk about. We never get any big water bills. We're not using a lot of it. It's more, I suppose, where we live, there's a lot of rain and you're trying to get water away. So there's a lot of places you could store water quite easily. Rainwater capturing off the roofs is an easy way to get it into 1,000-litre tanks and then use that water then for animals. Yeah, the main thing, I suppose, with water and us is trying to protect waterways, and with regenerative farming, you're generating, obviously, the whole environment, but the rivers and everything leading down to Mulroy Bay, But when you revive your soil, when you regenerate your soil, you're able to store a lot more water within that soil. Whenever you use all these inputs, you actually sterilize your soil. So to wake your soil up again and to have it fully functioning, you could be able to store up to 12 times more water within your soil through carbon sequestration. So it's within everyone's interests to let your soil absorb more water, so your land is less wet, so your grass will grow longer, so you can drive on it, walk on it, whatever it is you have to do. So the whole thing is a holistic approach to farming. It's the whole system, it's the whole ecosystem, it's the farms, it's the communities, it's the land, it's everything linked.
It's very much a family affair. You have small children as well, and you're saying that you have kids coming in from preschool the whole way up. How have you found children engaging with this way of farming? Because from doing this project, I've been blown away with how, first of all, clever they are and how intimate they are.
Yeah, like one good example is always when we bring R2 over to the polytunnel. Like, our wee girl wouldn't eat spinach or tomatoes if you took it out of the fridge and give it to her.
Mm.
But eating them off the vines is eating the salad from the ground. Like, you know.
And it's, yeah, can't get enough of it.
Can't get enough. Like, has a tomato in every hand, you know, just eating bites off one and sitting down and going for another one. With the children then that come, I suppose, when they first get off the bus, it's kind of, you know, like any interaction with children, they're all a bit sort of quiet and not sure what to say. As we start going down the farm and meeting the animals, we then end up, we always base our tours around low tide. So we go down onto the shore and look for crabs and eels and start to just reconnect them with everything, and that just blows their minds.
The excitement by the end of the tour is incredible. And
the questions be flowing, like the crack these 90, you know, they just want to know more and want to come back. But we try and tell them, you know, to go down to the shore, all you need is a bucket. Like, you can go and do it yourself. Like, that is completely free.
Mm.
We're just trying to reconnect you with what is around you.
Yeah, and I suppose in a world where, you know, there's an epidemic of children's mental health, like, I've seen it from the pharmacy side of things, of to see something as simple as just bringing kids out into nature and the difference in them in 2-2.5 hours, like, they're like different children, you know. It's something that, yeah, we think that side of our work is just incredibly important and lovely to be able to offer that to children.
Are the animals, like, totally free roaming through that, or what way have you organized?
No, so within nature, we're just trying to mimic that same setup.
Mm.
Hens are obviously an animal that everything can and could eat if it wanted. So we have to protect the hen. So they're within, I built a hen house on a trailer, and then they have electrified netting that protects them. So it's, you know, high enough that they won't fly out. We do get the odd one that flies out, and because of where we live, you know, Mr. Fox is there waiting sometimes. But we try and keep them safe with the electrified netting. Every 2 days, then we move them. The cattle are, our fields are divided up into smaller paddocks with a mobile water drinker, so the drinker moves with the animals, and then they're obviously safe enough. So everything keeps moving. The pigs are in the forest. They have, we start them off in a small area. We open it up into a bigger area, then close off that area, let it regenerate, you know, move them on to the next paddock. Mm-hmm. And just try and keep them moving and keep them in an area with forage. So, yeah, as I said, pigs are kind of, that's where they're from. Cows obviously live in the field. Hens originally would have came from the jungle, so can't really explain that one, but they're just a useful tool for fertilising ground and scratching up the grass to stimulate new growth. And, yeah, our byproduct is then really, really, really good egg.
That sounds like an absolutely fantastic system they've going. They are open for private tours in the summer, but you can contact Michelle and Cahill by going on their website, mulroymeadowfarm.com, which I'll also have linked on the Irish Protect section of our own website, highlandradio.com. Michelle was telling me that they tailor the tours to suit the needs for the group, so give them a bell and they'll be able to get you sorted. I have been working on an exciting project alongside my helpful team of after-schoolers at TT Childcare in Ballybuffet. Whenever I visited them back almost 6 months ago, we put up a special mic called an audio moth, and that's used to record the sounds of nature. And scientists from Harvard and Copenhagen universities are going to analyse these recordings and identify species and monitor the ecosystems there. I've been doing it, and so has all of the other Arts to Protect presenters dotted across Ireland. So whenever the 6 months are up, I will hand the SD card back over to the scientists and we'll hear about what they discover. But I had a listen through to the audio, and my parting gift to you with Arts to Protect 2 are the interesting sounds from Ballybuffet in the middle of the night. So take care, and I'll speak to you next time.
This is with Donna Marie Doherty on Highland Radio. The kids are in charge to explore all things sustainable. Ours to Protect is funded by Commissioner Mann with a television licence fee and is a partnership between Highland Radio and the Independent Broadcasters of Ireland.